Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, "The bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve." These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, 2Manage Vets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to today's episode of The Bend. Now, today I have a special friend on, Ron Sosa, and Ron and I have known each other for a very long time because we kind of live in this periphery of people who like communication, who like training, who like kind of poking the bear a little bit at VetMed and making things change and shake up. So Ron is a longtime industry person. He is currently the executive director of Uncharted. I'm sure all of you are familiar with Dr. Andy Rourke and his team. And he's been doing that for over two years now, I guess, probably, right, Ron?
Yeah.
And then prior to that, he also for fun does a little part-time work with Pet Folk as a veterinary assistant. He owned some practices, sold them to Mission Veterinary Partners, and then he was training and development coordinator, hospital support learning and development manager. So he's all about teaching. And the other thing he does is he sits on the advisory board of Pima Medical Institute, which trains veterinary technicians. So Ron, man, thanks for being here. I'm excited to hear our conversation and always fun to talk with you.
And thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Like at a conference and running past each other in the hall, right? Waiting to get to class is how we usually see each other. Okay. So, So tell us a little bit. I like the origin story. Tell us a little bit about your origin story and how you got into vet med.
Oh, gosh. It was one of those kismet things that I fell into, right? And so I remember that I went to college for computer science, and I dropped out because I hated sitting and staring at a screen all day and not interacting with people. And so I actually answered an ad for customer service, and it wound up being a Banfield. And so I did the front desk at Banfield. Not too long later, I've been asked to help out in the vet assistant space. And then that led me to being more in the vet assistant. And then as I worked through that, I love studying. I love learning. Worked through with VSPN and did some of the teaching. Went into dermatology, went into practice management, and then went into to owning some piece of some practices. So I was a minority share owner. And then we sold in 2021. And then I worked for the corporation for a small amount of time. And then Andy called me up and said, "Hey, do you want a job? We're looking for a new executive director." And I'm, how do you say no to that? Exactly. So that's the long story short version of it. But yeah, it's kind of an interesting journey through my vet career.
You know, I gave a talk one day to some pre-vet students at North Carolina State. And it was kind of talking about career path. And, you know, they're like so hyper-focused on going to vet school. And I went, please understand that your career will not be a straight path. It will look more like a drunken sailor on a Saturday night.
It's so true.
And you just kind of fall into things. And that's what's happened to me. And it certainly, you know, happened to you. And I think to the best of us, because we take a little bit from every job we've had, and then we pull it into the next job, and we bring a little more to the table than if we had just followed that little straight line and that very narrow path. So, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is the practice sale, because I think that's kind of a scary proposition for a lot of people. And it's also a really hard transition, because if you are a practice owner and you are moving to all of a sudden you are not in control anymore, that I think is the greatest reason for the unhappiness after the sale. And I've talked to some people who work with consolidation, and about 20% of their acquisitions fail because of that reason, because the practice owner just can't handle it. So how did you feel when that transition happened?
I was not a happy camper. Because I owned a minority share, I didn't really have much of a say in the sale of the practice. And so I was not that happy as far as transitioning. I had this mindset of as soon as it sells, I'm out. Like I'm gonna find something else. But I started to believe in what the corporation was going for. They had me talk to several of their departments and trying to find a place for me in their corporation. And I did wind up going and learning development. And I was very strongly connected to my practices still. And it is hard to watch someone else control your baby when you've had so much control of it and they're not doing exactly what you would do. It is hard, but you almost have to put on, you would understand this, you have to put on your manager hat, right? And I have now delegated that management of the practice to someone else, and it's not going to look like how I did it. It's going to look how they did it. And I have to trust the fact that we found the right partner. And it's really hard and really scary, and it's simple to say, but I 100% agree with you. I think that that transition of power or that control, and it's no longer yours, is really, really hard to swallow and to watch and be a spectator in the practice rather than somebody who's doing and guiding and leading it through.
So I'm curious as to how did your team feel about that? Because oftentimes this is really a surprise to the team members. They walk in one day and somebody else is signing contracts for them and their PTO starts and their benefits change and everything is all of a sudden not what it was. And of course, for good reason, it has to be kept under your hat while this negotiation is happening. But how did you feel the transition to the team was made?
Yeah, I think we had a decent transition. We were pretty open and transparent from the moment we signed our letter of intent up until the sale. We had the conversation with the team. We were very transparent as to the why we were doing it and the why of who we chose and a lot of the reasons of why we chose the partner that we did. And I think when big change happens like that, we all go into this what's in it for me core, right? That hierarchy of needs. And we go into this like, what am I going to get out of this? What am I going to get changed out of this? And so what I saw is my team go into very much the pay first, right? What is my schedule? What is my pay? What is my, what is my, what is my? And as soon as we could answer those questions, as fast as we could answer those questions, I think all of the rest subsided. All of the change was okay because we met those needs first. It's like your pay is not changing, and here's why. And your schedule is not changing, and here's why. And this is what we're, there will be change. This is not part of the change right now.
Because that change is very scary. I read an article not too long ago about moving people into change, and of course we're all reluctant. We are creatures of habit, and I used to laugh when I was teaching my classes. I said, tell me every morning when you take a shower, what do you wash first? Think about it, because 100% of the time we start with the same place. And we are such creatures of habit, we don't think about it. Some people start with their hair. I actually start with my left arm. So I don't know why, it just starts there. But once you kind of put a light on it that says, understand that this is going to make you uncomfortable. And let's just own it. It's difficult to make these changes. And it's difficult to not go to Ron for the answers and have to go to whoever is out here in this regional supervisor position. And that's very challenging. So I like to talk to people about decision making. So you've moved through, multiple things, and tell me how you make a decision. You made a decision to go and start working with Andy at Uncharted, and that was kind of a different thing for you.
Yeah, it was a scary thing to move into because, when you've been in practice management for a long time, or if you've been, in a position for a long time, and then you make a somewhat of a career change because this is a very positional difference. There, it's a lot of scary thoughts, and it's a lot of that imposter syndrome that comes up. Am I good enough to do this? And like, why did I get the call? What did I do that was so special? So all of that flares up, or at least it did for me. But I have made myself a promise very, very early in life. And so I was brought up and we lived very, I hate to say, but poor lifestyle. And I remember my father getting these job opportunities or my stepmom getting these opportunities and never took them. And so I think very early on in my life, I have decided that I am always going to take advantage of an opportunity when it presents itself, not to the detriment, but as long as it's going to provide something for me or my family or advance what it is I'm trying to do in life, that I would take it. And so I think that's how I started with vet med. Like, I took advantage of somebody asking me to help out as a vet assistant. And then I wanted to learn as much as I could to help out in that role. I took advantage of, you know, someone asking me to step up and help manage their practice because they saw I wanted to take advantage of inventory and they saw I wanted to do these things. And so I took advantage of these opportunities to advance my career. But the selfish reason was because I wanted to give back and I wanted to be able to do and provide and do more. And so I think that still holds true today, that I want to take advantage of these opportunities to talk with you on your podcast right now, to be able to share some of the pitfalls that I have done as a manager. You know, I wish I could take some of that back and apply better. What I know today.
Oh my gosh.
If I can help someone else, right, not fall into those pitfalls, yes, or I can help guide the next person, the next generation, that's what I want to do. And so I take advantage of the opportunities.
Yes. I was talking to Josh Weissman on my podcast recently. And of course, Josh has written this like wonderful book, and our books are very complimentary. And so we were talking about, we've done book signings together. And I said, man, if I had known when I started what I know now, if I had had these books to tell me this stuff, the sky is the limit. I mean, I probably would have had 100 hospitals, right? I could have just, you know, you really could have done it. And had such a great team and a great culture.
Yeah.
You know, and I got there, but it took a long time of trial and error to get there, that you really want to share with other people, like, these are my screw ups. Don't do that. You know, instead do this. And this will bode well for you in the future. And I really feel like that's why I love to work with startup practices.
Yeah.
They're just this blank slate, and the owners, if they're receptive to listening, they're sponges and they want to learn. And veterinarians are so intelligent that once they get a concept, they can take it and run with it, but they have to have the concept brought to them. And that's the fun part for me of coaching new practice startups. It's a blast to do. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing as the executive director for Uncharted. What are your roles?
Oh, goodness. It means just like it means in the practice, you wear all the hats. believe it or not, Uncharted is actually a really small team. We've got a team of 9 people, and we put on 2 live conferences a year. We put on 4 virtual summits a year, and we're doing these road shows. And so I wear a mix of different hats. I look at the financial viability of the practice, so to speak, right, of the business, help with forecasting, help with decision-making. Are we following our vision? Are we on the right mission? Are we taking advantage of the opportunities that are actually within our mission, vision, and values that we're working on? Or are we taking advantage of an opportunity because it's an opportunity, right? And trying to keep those guardrails up. And really, my focus has been on systematizing and efficiency within Uncharted. And so that's kind of been my main focus. Andy Rourke is an amazing human being, right? And if you know him, I don't think he would care if I said this, but he's a little bit of a squirrel. He's a great visionary. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Amazing visionary. And what he needs is a counterpart of system and structure around it so that those can complement each other.
Yes.
And so I think that's where I fit in the best. It's like, yes, I bring in systems and efficiency into the team so that they can best do the things that they do. Like, mm-hmm, Stephanie and Andy are so creative, and they're just, I don't know. I'm so fortunate to work with amazing people that I could just talk about it all day.
I think you made a really wonderful point. And I think that any manager out there needs to pay attention to this, because if you have people on your team who are extremely creative, put them to work doing those things. But then if you have your detail-oriented organizers and label maker people, and you know, my favorite thing on earth is a label maker. So just put those people to work doing the things that they love to do. And then you have this great meld of people who can do, you know, they see things from different perspectives, and you don't expect everybody to fit in this same mold. And I feel like a lot of managers think, you know, it's my way or the highway, you have to do it this way. But if we listen more than we talk, we will manage better.
Oh man, I feel like the role of a manager is not to manage anything. It is to facilitate the rest of everyone else to manage the place, which is
Exactly right. Yeah. You know, I when my when I was going to leave my practice, my first practice, I managed for 19 years, and I
Oof.
kind of was raised in that hospital, starting out as a part-time receptionist. I left and managed a couple of retail shops, and I came back as the hospital administrator. And my boss used to laugh and threaten me, if you ever leave, I'm coming after you with a shotgun. And I said, Doc, if I ever leave, you will never know I'm gone, because everybody on this team is trained, they know their jobs, and they know what to do. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, I gotten to the point I was bored, because everybody stayed and I didn't have any turnover, and people knew their jobs so well. It was just like automatic. It was like this Ferrari engine that never needed tuning, right? It just kept running. And so I got out and I started working at another hospital that was a hot mess. And I my challenge was back again, right? So I was like, you use those creative juices to kind of pull the next one into the same mold that you had that first one going in down the right track.
That's so
So I'd
true.
love to talk about these things. What do you think is your biggest career mistake?
Oh gosh, biggest career mistake. I feel like there's so many of them.
Maybe it was that computer science class, right?
That's probably true. I wish, honest to God, looking back, you're probably not that far off. I never thought of veterinary medicine as a career. Like I remember loving going to taking our pets to the vet. I remember loving like it being so interested in what was happening in the vet hospital and watching the doctor do the, I had ferrets and we had dogs and so just like watching everything, but I never thought of it as a career. And I think that's still true to this day for a lot of people. It's like we see outsiders see vet profession is not necessarily a career. And I think that's why we have an attrition problem, or we have that turnover problem, we have that burnout problem. It's not looked at. It's still looked at as like the stepping stone to something else. And I don't want to be a McDonald's industry. I want to be a career. I want vet med to be a career.
Oh, that is, you have just made an excellent point. And I thinking about just when I was going to teach that class for the pre-vet students, I talked about being a CVPM and managing hospitals, and the light bulbs were going off in that room, because they never knew that they could do that. They never knew there was an alternative to working with animals other than being a veterinarian. I'm like, sure, we desperately need managers. We desperately need good trained managers, because a lot of times we just kind of force people to be a manager because they were a good technician or a good CSR, and then we don't teach them anything, and you know, fuss at them when they don't do a good job, or wonder why they're quitting. So it is a career. And just to let you know, a couple of friends and I have started, Rhonda Bell, who you know, another CVPM, Dr. Jill Clark, we have started an association for CSRs, and it's NAVR, the National North American Association of Veterinary Receptionists. And we're going to do the launch and start membership acquisition at AVMA this year in Austin, Texas. But we just felt like that is a career, and it is not a throwaway job. It is not a way to get to the back, although some people certainly do get their foot in the door at the front desk. But there are people who work for me who worked the front desk for 20 years, 25 years, 30 years until they retired. And they were so well trained that my doctor's burden was much less, because they could handle so many of the calls and answer the questions, and the client trust was off the charts because they saw them for generations of animals, not just the one that they came in with, but two and three dogs later, they were still seeing the same people in practice. And that is such a key to the success of a hospital, is building those relationships. So absolutely, vet med is a career, but it's veterinary, being a veterinarian is not the only career.
That's right.
And that
And
is
it's not being a veterinarian is not the destination. Like I
no.
think that's, a lot of times we get people come into VetMed and they're like, I'm going to be a vet. And I came in a similar mindset, like, oh, I'm going to do this because I want to, the linear, you know, progression was be a CSR, be a technician, be a vet. And it's not at all, not at all. I remember when people ask me, when I do some training in the pet folk now, and I've had some new trainees and they're like, oh, why didn't you become a vet? Or like, what's the difference? Like, should I be a vet or should it be a tech? Like, what should I go to? And I'm like, well, there's definitely a financial aspect, but that aside, do you want to do the work or do you want to talk about the work?
Yeah.
Because in my mind, and this is no disrespect at all, but like vets, they talk about the work. They talk to the clients about the work, and the technicians are the ones that get to do the work, right? Other than surgery, they're the ones with their hands on the pet,
right?
And they're the ones doing it. And so that's, I think that's where VetMed needs to go for vet techs to be appreciated. But that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, it is a whole other topic. The point that you made, and I made this to Ken Yagi, I said, I think that one of the things that we're missing is the veterinarians like to do the fun stuff, right? And so instead of just talking about the medicine, they like to do the work too. And that's where the leveraging is a challenge. So I really believe if we don't start teaching veterinarians in vet school to work with technicians in vet school, that they will come out being technicians, right? And there's the challenge of it. Tell me about how you think networking has helped you in your career. Because a lot of people look at networking and go, ooh, you know, like, but obviously you and I are kind of like, oh yeah.
Networking in my mind is the cornerstone of doing more in the profession. So I will say that it took me losing a job. And there, so just rewind for a second. I moved from New York City down to Phoenix, and I had my New York City attitude. And I will be very upfront with, I was not probably a nice person when I first moved. Just culturally, there's difference in how you speak and how you interact with people. And so it took me losing my job and going, oh my gosh, I don't want to ruin my reputation, for me to start networking and really put myself out there to be like, this is who I am, not I'm not this thing that happened to me. And so it really propelled me to network and get to know people. And like, I formed manager groups because I wanted to know what someone else was doing. And like, how could I do it differently? Or how could I be better? And I formed those groups because back then, I don't know if you probably remember, Deb, like it was very much this competitive vibe.
Oh, absolutely.
And so when I remember forming practice manager groups, it was like, why would you do that? Why are you going to give the competition your upper hand? And it's like, no, like, we have so much to teach each other. And I tell you, it puts gasoline on your on the fire of your career. Like, it really does expand and propel your career exponentially.
Well, when I was managing in Greensboro, North Carolina, well, our Novartis rep, of course, Novartis home office was there. So we had a lot of interaction with the team there. And they started bringing us once a month to lunch, the managers that of their, you know, their major hospitals. And it was a great collaboration. But I do remember my boss saying, you're just going to tell them all our secrets. I went, there are no secrets. You know, we're all just trying to deal with the same craziness. And
that's right.
You know, we made ourselves a pact. And of course, I shouldn't be telling this, you know, out in the world, but we did make a pact that said, you know, I'll call you if somebody said they work for you and you will tell me the truth if they are crazy, if they're a thief. So we had that little pact among us. But you're right. I mean, because everybody has the similar pain and other people have found solutions. And I think that was just, to me, one of the most joyful things I noticed during the middle of the pandemic was watching the practice manager groups on social media collaborate. Well, it was amazing. People were giving ideas about how to manage people in the parking lot and communication out to the clients and how they were using Zoom to have like almost in-person exams with the client as they sat in the car. I mean, it was brilliant. The collaboration that happened, and we probably would not have made it through as well as we did, even as hard as it was, without those managers collaborating the way they did. So it, you know, it just showed what you can do as a profession when you work together for it.
Oh, I agree. I think there's something special to be had when you find that tribe, right? When you find your group of people, there's just something special that happens and you just become bonded to each other. You lean on each other. Like you share the similar struggles, you share the similar successes, and the creativity is just amazing and outstanding. And I know I talk about this from like a healthy conflict lens, in some of my talks, but really like opening your world to multiple lenses will change it and it will give you creativity and innovation.
Absolutely. One of the things I wanted to make a point to talk to you about when you said about
Yeah.
my talks that triggered my memory. I want to talk to you about talking about neurodiversity in
Yeah.
profession because we've had a brief conversation about this and I think it's fascinating to me. I was on a thread on LinkedIn last night that just brought in a whole bunch of really interesting stuff to the table
Yeah.
about depression and the different like ADHD and all the different things that are happening sort of in a whole generation of people really. And I personally have dyslexia. It is certainly not as strong as some people, but I can remember being, 10, 12 years old and struggling to read the face of a watch
Yeah.
because I have to concentrate on it. I have to look and concentrate and turn those hands around in my mind. And D's and B's flip for me, which Debbie Boone is a challenge, right? I find myself writing my D's backwards all the
Yeah.
time. But talk a little bit about your perspective on that and what you talk about, and kind of what you see out there in the profession.
Yeah, I think that for me, it started as being late diagnosed ADHD in my early 20s. And I was, I was the manager I didn't ever want to be, where I was, had low tolerance of frustration. I remember blowing up at my staff one time and I'm like, that is not who I want to be. Like, I never want to yell at my staff, right? And I was so upset with myself. And I wound up going to, I was also having, problems in my relationships, and we went to couples counseling, and it really came down to me going to anger management, which is what I thought I was like having to deal with. And it came out, it was like, no, I got a diagnosis of ADHD, and it was like, there's a reason that there's this low tolerance of frustration. It just, I'm in a position now that triggers that, and how can I work with myself, and what are the things that that means? And so it led me down this rabbit hole of neurodiversity very early on in my mid to late 20s. And then what happened is, I was going to, oh, I think I was going back to therapy for something else. Oh, it was pandemic related, and I got into this really bad funk, like a lot of us, right? You go into that like depressive thing, and I went back to a psychiatrist, and I was we were debating about starting medication, and then it I don't know, a light bulb went off, and he said, "Have you ever been tested for autism?" And I was like, "No, it's something that's never crossed my mind." And I went home, I started, researching. I'm like, this guy's crazy, he's a quack, there's no way. And then he w went back to the next session. He's like, listen, I can't officially diagnose you because that's not my specialty. He's like, but I really think you should go to an autism specialist and get tested. And it's really hard as an adult to find a place that does that, or even accept you to do that. But I went down this rabbit hole. It was like it opened my whole world of who I was because so many things made sense in my life as I started to understand this world of neurodiversity and the world of ADHD and the world of autism and how they and how, they represent or they have present in life. And so now I'm on this tour to just bring the information to light, bring the information to the world, because it is such this the hidden disability is really hard for people to understand. It's like you look at career paths like, like you, like how can somebody so successful have dyslexia? How can somebody, and you look at all of our, not all, but a good portion of entrepreneurs out there have ADHD or autism. They are on the spectrum of neurodiversity somewhere. And so when you start to see that, you realize that they have played to the strengths of their neurodivergent self. And so, yeah, I'd love to bring that to vet med because we are so far behind. as you know, on our communication, on our acceptance, on our, I think, diversity training as a whole. And this is just one piece of the pie I want to bring to the table.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. I mean, I really do. I have a friend whose son was late diagnosed with ADHD. And she said, oh, I feel like such a bad mother, because we thought this kid was just like, he would have these rages. And like, we walked into the house one time, he had this big dent in the stainless steel refrigerator where he had banged his head into it. And this is a kid that's in high school, played football, and he made a pretty good dent. But she said, now, you know, we found out like he's in college and he's struggling, and all of a sudden we get him on medication and all of a sudden his grades are improving. So I think what we're missing is the signs and symptoms and paying attention to things. And then, like my mom said, you know, she said, I feel bad. She said, you know, we couldn't figure out why you couldn't spell. And to this day, my husband will spell a word out loud. I went, you know, I can't do that. I have to see it in order to tell you what it is, but I can read anything. I mean, just, you know, I have no problem reading, and I read rapidly and I read in large groups. Those people who have some kind of neurodiversity are highly intelligent. In fact, their IQs are above average. And I think that makes sense, because you have to figure out how to do life, right? And
it's
so
true.
It challenges your brain every single day to go into different paths that supposedly normal people don't have to function through to get things done that you want to accomplish.
Well, there's statistics out there, and I don't remember them exactly offhand, but I think it's neurodivergent individuals face three times the amount of negative comments in their life than the neurotypical person. And so you, to your exact point, like, we have to overcome a lot more negativity. We have to overcome a lot more challenges. And I think that really builds resilience that I didn't necessarily even know that I had until I watched counterparts, you know, fall apart in similar situations. And it's like, how did you make it through? Like, what are you doing differently? It's like, I just had a higher tolerance for resilience because of what I've faced. And so I think that has been, you know, a double-edged sword, right? Because in a lot of ways, I think it's held me back in my life, not knowing and not understanding. And in other ways, it's really propelled me to be as successful as I am today.
Absolutely. I agree. I can remember, you know, kind of people making fun of me because I couldn't tell time and it would take me so long. And my husband would say, you know, and of course we're riding down the road, and instead of saying right and left, I point, and he went, quit pointing. I'm driving. I can't, you know, you have to say right and left, but I have to stop and think, and I have to think right or left hand, right? It's not, it doesn't come easy. And it doesn't come naturally to people who have to work through it. But there's actually a LinkedIn group that Richard Branson has, and they're for dyslexic people. And it talks a lot about the different things that people who are dyslexic do. But sometimes I wonder if undiagnosed people are some of the reason that we are suffering greatly in the practices, because we do have a highly intelligent by default group of people who are working in the practices, and often we have that bad behavior, those bad communication skills, and you wonder why, because no logical person thinks that by screaming at people you're going to accomplish anything, right? You're not going to do that. But how can they stop their behavior? Well, maybe the behavior is undiagnosed in some way, shape, or form. The other interesting thing that I was reading about neurodiversity is, and this person on this thread wanted veterinarians to get involved in the research for it, because it is the chemicals that we're exposed to in utero, and that there's a whole generation. So you're a lot younger than I am. So I think about, you know, my mother grew up on a farm, and everything I ate as a child came from my grandparents' farm. So it was kind of like we were organic before it was organic, and farm to table eating kind of thing. Because my mom had a garden in the backyard, and that's what we ate when we were young. But there's a whole group of younger people who were raised on McDonald's, fast food, and Roundup in the earth, and herbicides and pesticides, and this kind of chemical cocktail soup that, according to this research, has caused a lot, an increase in ADHD and autism and some of the other neurodiverse things. That, so we need to have that awareness too. Is like, we are what we eat. We actually are what our parents ate.
It's true.
And there's a predisposition to it too. So there's all there's, so I think there's a lot of investigation to be done, a lot of research to be done, a lot of awareness to be brought to the table. But thank you for sharing that, because I think that somebody, it might just trigger a light bulb for somebody. I know I had a conversation with Kelly Cronin, and she's dyslexic, and we talked about some of the challenges that we were having, just, you know, with math. And I hate math. So anyway, and I do math a lot, so I can do the math, but I don't love the math. I would much rather talk to people. So I really am interested. Do you have, I always like the fun fact, secret talent. You're working with Andy, do you do comedy too?
I don't, and I don't even try, because it is nowhere near that level of good. And I try to do the dad jokes. It just, it doesn't compare. So I'm like, yeah, I don't even try.
Did you ever... on LinkedIn, almost every Friday, sometimes he fails us, but Matt Saloy puts the dad jokes on there, or the puns. And I have so much fun with those things, because I actually sit and work to try to think. And he did one day about spice, some kind of spice. I opened my spice drawer and I kind of created this really long thread about all these different spices in the pun. And he just went, wow, Deb, that was amazing. I just looked at the spice drawer. but I love those kind of little mental challenges that show up around. And then it's kind of fun to connect with people like that, that you, you know, you really don't have opportunity to see a lot of them in person, but there's always a way to stay connected with people. So any final words of wisdom, if you were going to, you have like a somebody who's looking at you and going, gee, Ron, tell me all about VetMed and what I should do and what I shouldn't do. What are the words of wisdom?
What the one thing I want to say, and it's about neurodiversity, is we're not, what awareness is bringing is not the ability for a manager to try and diagnose their team, right? Because we want you to be aware of the traits and why the traits are there, so that we can work with a person as an individual human being. Like, it's simple as it sounds. We just treat our team like a human being. Doesn't matter what generation they're from, doesn't matter what neuro condition they have or what race or background, all of that melts away if we can just treat our team like a human being and get to know them on a personal level. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it really comes down to, is just getting to know the person on a human level.
Yep, I agree with you 100%. I was listening to a lecture at VMX Charisse Roth was doing, and one of the things that she said that really triggered me, and I thought, I never thought about this, was that dress codes are bias. Yeah. And I went, oh, yes, I could see that. I really could see where you said, you know, dress like a bank teller and wear this, this, and this, or your hair has to be this and the tats have to be this. And I said, it never occurred to me, but now I see it, now that you've brought it to light, and I could see why it's very important to have a dress code that is neutral, right? Yeah. I mean, this is the reason that we have dress codes anyway, is because we want to look a certain way to the public and a uniform way to the public. But I think sometimes if we don't, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right?
Yeah.
Until you start to learn and study things, then you may look at this and go, oh, this is just like nonsense. This is what woke mess. No, it is not. It really is not. The real lesson here is just don't be an asshole, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's it. You're right. All people are individuals. And usually the lesson I train is, when you use the word all in a sentence, you are automatically screwing up. Because every single soul on this earth is unique and individual, and you cannot, and it's a brain science thing. We like to lump people into categories because it's fast, and it makes us not have to work as hard mentally. But you can't do that, because people are individual. And I often wonder if people would say the things they say to people face to face, if they, you know, they say it online, but would you say that to somebody face to face?
No.
And then if you would, you need some serious help, because why would you? That is
Yeah.
inappropriate, to say the least. Well, Ron, thank you very much
Thank
for spending
you.
some time with me today. It's always a pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you again at the next event. Will you be at
Yes.
AVMA?
I am not going to be at AVMA this year, but I will be at VHMA if you're going to be there.
I met because I think it's in Charlotte. Is it coming back to
It
Charlotte?
is. It
Yeah, it's in
is.
my backyard. So I like to, I do conferences. I don't do as many conferences as I used to. So I try to do the ones that are close to home. And
Yeah.
I actually was supposed to be a keynote speaker for Fetch Long Beach this past time. And I said, you know what? That is a long way from South Carolina to fly across the country to give a 1 hour presentation and fly back. I went, no, I don't think so. So, but thank you. Try something closer to me.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you again for your time. And I will put your information in the show notes. So if people have questions or they want to reach out to you about any of the things we talked about, and I certainly look forward to seeing some of your topics on neurodiversity in
Yeah.
the near future, because I think it is something we do need to be talking about. We do have an awareness of. We're doing a pretty good job of talking about diversity as far as race goes, but this is another part of diversity that we need to pay attention to.
It's true. It's just another piece of the puzzle, another chunk of the pie of the entire diverse world.
Exactly.
So
Exactly.
thank you. Thank you for bringing light to it.
You're quite welcome. And thank you to our audience for listening to this episode of The Bend. I so appreciate your time today, and I hope that you enjoyed it and you have learned something that helps you in your life.